Alright, this is Pure Decking, show number 521 for Thursday, May the 25th, 2023. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and I think more indie games should be going back and using the old open source ports of the engines, like Doom, Build, I'm sure somebody's cloned a StarCraft or Warcraft engine, and using those to make games rather than, you know, whatever the latest Unreal is and shit like that, and just churn them out, you know? If you're not dealing with trying to, you know, in the old days, those engines were more focused, or Quake, what's the open source Dark Places? Because the challenge in those days was to get the thing to run at all on a 486 with no graphics accelerator, but these days, those engines, you know, or the open ports of them, source ports of them, I mean, you got to be able to push these things beyond anything from back in the day and probably make some pretty good stuff with the limitations. And, you know, it'll run on anything that way. So I think that's what more people who want to make indie games should do. They can just churn them out and focus on, you know, level of the game, the enemies, the gameplay, not worry about making everything look like it's out of a fucking, you know, Hollywood movie. Because I don't know about you guys, but I've noticed a lot of older game engines, like the old Doom, Duke Nukem, you know, the game would have 30 or 40 maps in it. A lot of the modern ones have, like, 10. And it's because, you know, they put so much detail into them. But anyways, tonight we have a madman. What's up, madman?
Yeah, I'm cool with lower graphics quality and more maps. I mean, I've been doing retro gaming lately.
Yeah, me too, so maybe that's where it's coming from. That and playing, what the hell is it called? Head On? They actually made this RPG game in the GZ Doom engine, and it's great. I mean, some of the graphics look like they're right off somebody's DeviantArt page, but gameplay's good, it's solid. They've expanded it out. Al Hazard was talking about some of the old System Shock games in the IRC before we started the show. And, System Shock 2, you can go get some mods to get the engine up to date and run it at higher res. Runs fine. Because, you know, they actually worried about making sure the game loop was fun in those things rather than just, you know, here's the shiny graphics and, you know, the next version of all the military guns we could think of. So, or hell, make it like some of those wacky Doom mods we saw where, like, you know, the shotgun with 20 barrels or whatever the fuck. I mean, hell, let's have some fun with it. But, anyways, and we have an Are You?
Oh, so a hectic day on my end, so.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that too, so we'll just let that lie where it is. Oh, yep. There was probably a better way to phrase that. Anyways. So, I don't know what you think about the classic game engines, are you?
I'd like to see them come back. Actually, I'd like to see some company make a console that's not required for the internet and have an exclusive title made with open software.
That's a damn good idea.
You could download this from whatever and stick it in your console at home. And then, these games can range from whatever. As long as it's open source stuff, you can sell it. And then go back to the popularity. You know, games win on gameplay. You get popular on your own merits and not because Steam put you on the front page as a sale.
Well, and two, you know, you mentioned a console. And for the longest time, I was always of the opinion, PC gaming is better. And but now that I look back on it, you know, these days, everything runs on top of, you know, Windows mostly, or layers emulating Windows on the Linux side of the house, or other layers, OpenGL, whatever. So, you know, it's all, you know, it doesn't really matter what hardware you have. It's all running on these layers. The hardware just kind of dictates how fast it's going to be. But, you know, back in the day, it was a real debate. You know, was a Sega better than a Nintendo?
Everybody had their fanboy for one or the other.
Well, sure, but you actually had significant differences. I'm thinking, well, okay, I'm especially thinking the Super Nintendo versus the Genesis. Because the Super Nintendo had that souped-up 6502 in it. I think that's what it was. And the Genesis had a Motorola 68000 in it. Like, that's a legit difference. Because Super Nintendo was light on the CPU, but then had its own custom, you know, graphics engine in it. Whereas the Genesis had a much stronger CPU, but I don't think their graphics engine was quite as flexible. And so you, like, had legitimate...
The Super Nintendo was definitely better when it came to Arcade Perfect. It just had a much better graphics setup.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sega definitely had the depth in the games that they could play.
Well, Sega didn't limit themselves either. Because Nintendo always tried to kind of maintain that squeaky clean... You know, that's kind of the gag, is going back now and finding people who've put together compilations of how the Japanese games were censored for the U.S. market, right? So,
yeah,
you know, that's... There's a lot of games that Sega would put out that Nintendo just wouldn't. And, of course, the same thing when you get into the later stage consoles, you know, like the PlayStation 1 versus the Nintendo 64 versus the Xbox. There were all significant differences in those in the hardware stack. But
I'm not a great fan of Nintendo, never have been, but mm-hmm. I've got to tip my hat of their commitment. They have a vision and a brand,
and they're
maintaining
it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this modern world, I've got to respect that. They're not blowing in the wind where, you know, game magazines want them to go. They're like, here's a product, like it or don't, later.
Well, but I'm wondering how much of the current batch of consoles are really just PCs running restricted hardware these days, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe not quite that bad, but... Well, not that that's a bad thing, but maybe not quite to that level. I mean, that's what the Xbox definitely was this crippled PC. But because of, you know, the porting of the games between them, they all seem to do it fairly easily unless there's a contract in place or it's a first-party title that, of course, won't release it for any other system. But I'm thinking in terms of, like, especially the 16-bit and even the 8-bits, these systems had significant differences to them, and the people writing the software for them, this even gets into, like, you know, the 8 and 16-bit computers, like the Ataris, the Commodores, stuff like that, where these, you know, but the hardware was what it was. It wasn't this constantly moving forward thing like a PC is, where, you know, you, as long as you're buying the latest graphics card, and you can kind of do whatever. But, you know, an Amiga 500 was a set thing. An Atari 800 was a set thing. A, you know, Super Nintendo was a set thing. You know, they historically, whenever they tried to make add-ons that were required for games, unless they came with a console, they didn't do that well. You know what I mean?
Sega tried that with the...
With the Genesis, they had the CD,
yeah,
and the 32X.
And the 32X, yeah. And the Sega CD, some of their games were really cool, and the first time I saw actual video in a game was on a Sega CD.
Yeah,
but it didn't catch on because you have to buy an add-on.
Or in the case of,
I still
have
scars on my hands from a 32X.
Well, and that's the thing is it got really stupid where you had a game that required both the CD drive and the 32X to play. So it's like, you know, your audience goes from everyone with a Genesis or a Genesis clone, because there were three or four versions of those and the copies, to you know, the handful of people that have bought all the accessories and built the Tower of Power that the thing could do. Because couldn't you, like, stack five or six different things?
Yes, it was fucking ridiculous before it was over.
Yeah.
And to its credit, I think that thing was on par with, like, the original Sega or Sony PlayStation.
With the 32X and the CD? Yeah, it absolutely
power.
Was.
Yeah, it was.
And it was the next-gen console before the next-gen console came out. But well, there wasn't a market for it.
Well, Sega's problem...
Years.
Sega's problem was that the American market tried to do the 32X and the Sega CD, and the Japanese market, they abandoned the Genesis and went straight for the Dreamcast around that time. It was the Saturn.
Saturn. Yeah.
So they split their market.
The Saturn was great.
Oh, well, I had a Saturn.
It
I loved
titles.
It.
Yeah, it lacked titles.
Oh, did anyone else play the Sega Master System?
Yes. I still have four. And I have a Game Gear.
Oh.
I did play a Master System. I didn't have
about
one.
Stacking the Game Gear stuff, dude. Then you get a Tower of Power with that and snap your fucking wrists.
Well, the problem with the Game Gear was the batteries would die before you finish the damn game.
Yeah, and there was no way to... There was no warning system. It just shut off.
Color screen before the color screen was doable, or before Nintendo had it. And I watched TV shows on a Sega Game Gear.
Oh, yeah, they had that tuner for it.
Yeah. Exactly. You could stack so much shit on top of that thing. It became ridiculous.
But...
Yeah, I remember the Master System, and no one I'd know really outside of this group ever heard of him. Like, yeah, it was the Sega's equivalent to the original Nintendo.
Yeah, it was the 8-bit.
And I'm kind of wrong, because they had two systems. The SG-1000, and then the Master System was a step up from that. The SG-1000 was their Nintendo. The Master System was Nintendo Plus.
Well, the point I was getting at with, though, was each of those builds, they had their own specific feel to them, but because that hardware didn't change, as people got better at programming them, because, like, you know, it's an easy thing to do, but you look at the games that were coming out on the NES when the thing first came out versus what they looked like at the end of it. Or, hell, just compare Super Mario Brothers, the one that came with the
one
console.
1-3.
Yeah. You know, people got better at programming them, and Nintendo figured out how to put memory mappers in the cartridges.
Yeah, the dancing background, the sprites all looked better. Yeah.
Well, I mean, hell, they figured out how to put a low end 3D accelerator in a cartridge on the Super Nintendo. So, but you know, whole freaking coprocessor in every game. But
and there was a racing/off-road game for Nintendo that I thought was awesome because it did mini rock and roll music. I mean, like AC/DC and stuff. They got actual rock bands licenses and just recorded it in mini and had it on the game.
Oh, in the chip, it made it
on the
chip
different
tune?
Tracks.
Yeah,
yeah.
But but you know that hardware wouldn't change. So Ryu's idea of a dedicated console. It's like, this hardware is what this hardware is. Write your game to it.
Yeah.
I love that idea. Because, you know, now, granted, I mean...
Isn't that kind of what the console is now?
Yeah, it is. But it's...
You gotta hook it up to the internet, and if you don't have a fucking account, it locks you out.
Okay, so I'm thinking the last consoles I played, because I stopped consoles completely at PlayStation 2, Xbox One. And you didn't need that shit for those guys.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Like, it's proven that you can have a home console that can play decent games and large, complex games with multiple graphics sets. And, yeah, let's put it back in the developer's hands. If you can make a good game and sell it, make it downloadable, writable to a CD or multiple CDs, I'm envisioning a home hardware system that has 500 gig of memory. You know, decent graphics card. You know, nothing bigger than a 1070 or anything like that. You can play pretty much anything on a 1070 at the moment. And I don't know what sort of operating system, but yeah, let's get gaming back to if you can make and put out a good game, people can buy it and download it. No sign-ups, no fucking emails, just product.
Well, like, I've got a Switch I'm going to be modding, and yeah, I've intentionally not set up any accounts on it. It's kind of interesting because it's kind of like, it'll play the game. If you have a game on cartridge, it will play it, but it really harps at you to connect the thing to the internet.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a pain, and there's a lot of stuff on it that just won't work unless you've given it an account. Yeah. But
I'm sort of thinking, remember the good old DOS days? Where you just go online and you could get a game.
Sure.
And those games were great, and they survived if they were good. You'd get plenty of downloads if you're good.
Yeah, the old shareware days.
Yeah. Oh, I missed that word, shareware. I remember that.
So.
The word I remember. Haven't heard in a long time. Yeah.
But, so, RU sent me this article. I thought this would be interesting. I've got reasons I want to talk about this. It's from VideoGameChronicle.com. Switch hacker Gary Bowser, released from jail, will pay Nintendo 25 to 30% of his income for the rest of his life. So, I've got all kinds of
problems. I think there should be a set dollar amount. I don't think there should be a percentage of your income.
It is a set dollar amount. It's just such a ridiculous amount, he's never going to pay it off. Also, the dude's in his 50s, so, you know, they're just looking at his income opportunities and saying, yeah, he's never going to pay it off. Bowser was sentenced in February 2022 to 40 months of prison for his part as a member of the hacking group called Team Executor, which began in 2013 creating and selling circumvention devices, enabling users to play illegal ROMs on consoles, including Switch and 3DS. Okay, they are really underpinning or downplaying what that is. So Team Executor's mods unlocked the consoles so that you could run any code you wanted, whether that was homebrew or pirated games. That's, you know, it let you do all of that. But because, you know, Nintendo's point was, oh, well, let you play pirated games. Obviously, it's a copyright circumvention device. And they went after him under that copyright law that lets you go after people for selling devices for circumventing copyright. And the dude served prison and has an absolutely absurd amount of damages to pay for selling mod chips for a console. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I guess you don't actually own your own console. It's not your hardware, because if according to Nintendo, if you modify it, you know, I think Futurama got that joke right. It's like, oh no, I modified something I own. I'm going to prison. In an interview with Nick Moses, as reported by Tor Freak, Bowser said, and most people are reporting on this story because the guy's last name is Bowser and he was hacking Nintendo's. It's like, yeah, haha, we get it. But look at this. I mean, ridiculous. Look at this shit. You know, 40 months in prison and 14.5 million in damages for mod chips for the Switch? I mean, are you out of your fucking mind?
How were they marketing the mod chips?
As mod chips?
Were they just saying this can run any software, or were they saying, install this and you can download pirated games?
They probably said both.
I think that's their issue. If they would have left off the pirated games, I think they'd be fine. They said this will let you run any software.
As a consumer, if you're buying an aftermarket mod chip, you know exactly what you're getting into.
I know, but there's a difference between saying, I'm coating this gun to prevent fingerprints on it, and I'm putting this coating on a gun to prevent corrosion. One is you're trying to make it hard for criminals to get caught. The other is you're making a gun that lasts longer.
I have
if you're looking at it from a different point of view.
Okay, I've actually got this for you. I have two Nintendo Switches. I bought the second one specifically because I wanted to mess around with homebrew on it. Because there were some interesting looking homebrew games, and I wanted to try writing some of my own. And it turned out, I thought it was the kind that you could soft mod. It's not. It's like one revision right after that. So I've got to do the mod chip. And I'm going to do the mod chip with the Pi Pico, because that looks interesting. Now, I've looked at the soldering for that. I'm going to need a lot of alcohol to do that soldering, because it's very fine pitch. But I'm going to flip and try to do it. But that's that particular Switch, I have two of them, because I have one that's signed into an account that I play the legit games on. I'm not intending to use it for piracy. I'm really wanting just to do my own software on it, because I think it'd be fun.
And that's why I asked, how are they marketing it? If they were marketing it as you can run any software on this, then I don't see them being morally or even legally wrong. They're modding existing hardware that you own.
I want to load Android on the damn thing. I mean, you know, see what I can do with it. If nothing else,
but
because
if marketing as this, let's break the law, then they're kind of admitting to what Nintendo's charging them with.
Yeah, but I mean, I was like, in all honesty, because I think the meme would be hilarious to show ham radio digital modes running an Android app running on the Switch, hooked up to whatever radio I hook it up to, because I think that would be hilarious. That's why I want to do this, honestly, is I want to do FT8 on a Nintendo Switch just so I can take a picture and post it to the internet and say, look at my madness. And for anybody who understood that chain of words, congratulations, you're as big a nerd as me. Anyways, so interview with Nick Moses, as reported by Torn Freak, Bowser said he was released from federal prison in late March and is now at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, where he's undergoing processing before returning to Canada. However, Bowser now has to fulfill the other part of his sentence, in which he has been ordered to pay $14.5 million in damages, of which a $10 million payment to Nintendo is considered the priority. In the interview, Bowser claimed he has paid $175 of this to date, which came from the job he was doing in prison. Nintendo was garnishing his wages of his $2 an hour prison job.
Oh.
But says upon his release, he'll have to start paying a percentage of his gross monthly income to Nintendo. Quote, with the agreement with Nintendo, the maximum they can take is between 25% and 30% of your gross monthly income, Bowser said, and I have up until like 6 months before I have to start making payments, unquote. In order to pay off Nintendo fully under the agreement, Bowser would have to earn at least $40 million before taxes. Given that Bowser is 53 years old, Torrent Freak suggests this means Bowser is unlikely to ever fully clear his debt and will likely be paying Nintendo for the rest of his life. In June of 2022, a transcript of Bowser's sentencing was received by Axios, in which Nintendo lawyer Ajaya Singh reportedly said the sentencing was a, quote, unique opportunity, unquote, to send a message about piracy. U.S. District Court Judge Robert Lansick seemingly agreed with Singh, stating that TV and movies regularly glorify hacking as sticking it to the man, giving the impression that there's no harm in it given how much money large corporations make. Okay, that's... wow. At one point, Lansick asked Singh, what can we do to convince people that there's no glorying in this hacking / piracy? Okay, hacking and piracy are not the same thing. Anyways, I'm going to stop before I have an aneurysm.
I'm a hacker pirate.
Yar.
I make journalism.
Yar. Yo-ho, fiddly-dee, watch me type out my code? That doesn't fucking work. I hate people. Who wrote this shit? Chris Scullin, suck an egg. Singh answered there would be a large benefit to further education of the public, unquote. Yeah, so other than hoping that Chris Scullin sits on something sharp, although he might, was he just quoting the judge? That may not be his fault. Yeah, he was quoting the judge and the lawyer. I shouldn't be yelling at Chris for writing the
story.
Well,
he still wrote it down. Doesn't matter.
Okay, I hope the Nintendo lawyer sits on attack then. I don't know. Pick an insult.
I mean, dude, that is fucking hardcore. The mob doesn't even fuck you up that bad for lack of payment. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, they did all but tie him up and break his legs. I mean, for mod chips for a Nintendo Switch.
The mouse is sitting there going, "Ooh, fuck, that was rough." Yeah, not even the mouse is willing to go that fucking hard.
Fuck that. The mouse is sitting there taking notes. Man.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, the mouse is sitting there going, "Fuck, Nintendo, holy shit. Oh, hold my beer."
Mickey's just over there going, "Well, geez, Satan. Want to calm down there?"
Exactly. That's the only other corporation I know that goes so diehard over copyright and theft and shit like that.
Jeez, I don't know, man. But I mean,
it does not fit the crime.
Honestly, well, our intellectual property laws are just out of control. They largely do not make sense to the modern day. Certainly not the digital stuff. So
ridiculous. I mean, I'm glad he's out of prison. He's got that going for him, but too bad he has to go to Canada now.
He's a resident of Canada, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
If I was him, I'd call up some of those team executor guys who still had some profits from the mod chips and be like, "Hey, can you fly me to somewhere that doesn't have an extradition treaty and just tell Nintendo to get bent?" I mean, he's not going to get to go home anyways. So, fuck, I don't know, man.
Rough.
Madman, you have anything else on that?
I was thinking, if you're trying to ditch extradition, you'd have to look out for Japan as well.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point.
Do they not have an extradition treaty with Japan or the U.S.?
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that's fucked. So, the rest of the stories I have for tonight are pretty much about why you shouldn't let companies collect your data willy-nilly. So, I can move on to the next one. Next? Okay. This one is from blog.pypi.org, P-Y-P-I.org. So, I don't expect a lot of... If you're not into Python work, you may not know what PyPy is. It's a package repository for the Python programming language. So one of the gags about Python is that there's a library for everything, and that's more true than not, at least when you're working with technology. I mean, it's not quite the XKCD comic of import soul, but... you know, there usually is a Python module for any major thing you want to do, and Python is the language a lot of people are using with interacting with, like, the AI stuff, where you're just submitting requests and getting it back. Python's actually pretty good for that. But, anyways, so this particular organization, they keep a package repository, so you can run... You know, from the command line, you can say pip install requests, as an example. That's a library I've used a few times. Requests is a Python library for making web requests, you know, posts and gets and things like that. So if you're trying to interact with an API or write a script that, say, goes onto a scammer's website and fills out all the form with random data from, say, a scraped 4chan posts and then submits it over and over and over again to fill their database with garbage. Not that I'm suggesting anything. You know, PyPy is a very useful tool for the Python programming language. And this was posted yesterday, the 24th. In March and April of 2023, the Python Software Foundation received 3 subpoenas for PyPy user data. All 3 subpoenas were issued by the United States Department of Justice. The PSF was not provided with the context on the legal circumstances surrounding these subpoenas. In total, user data was related to 5 PyPy usernames. User data related to 5 PyPy usernames was requested. The data request was for the names, including subscriber name, username, and screen name, addresses, including mailing, residential, business, and email addresses, connection records, records of session times and durations, and the temporarily assigned network address, such as IP protocol address, associated with those sessions, length of service, including the start date and the type of services utilized, telephone or instrument numbers, including the registration internet protocol address, means and source of payment of any services, including credit card or bank account number and billing records, records of all Python package index packages uploaded by the given usernames, and IP download logs of any Python package index packages uploaded by the given usernames. So, because they don't list what they were investigating, it's hard to make a judgment call about what they were doing. And I don't think PyPI has this much information on people because most of their accounts are just so you can, for the most part, link to GitHub packages. But anyways, the privacy of PyPI users is of utmost concern to the PSF and the PyPI administrators, and we are committed to protecting user data from disclosure whenever possible. In this case, however, PSF determined with the advice of counsel that our only course of action was to provide the requested data. As the Director of Infrastructure for the Python Software Foundation, fulfilled the request in consultation with the PSF Council. We have waited for the string of subpoenas to subside, though we were committed from the beginning to write and publish this post as a matter of transparency, and as allowed by the lack of a non-disclosure order associated with the subpoenas received in March and April 2023. So, what they're doing is they're going to be adding some API calls. In order to provide as much transparency as possible, the following will detail the shape and extent of the data that was contained in the responses to these subpoenas. So they're actually showing the database calls they made into their internal database for trying to collect the information they had, and it shows just what data PyPI has on their users. And they've got a lot of what they were asking for, at least usernames, IP addresses, and connection times. You know, I mean, there's not, you know, they didn't have any telephone numbers, but of course they shared the IP addresses. Records of source of payment, of course, PyPI doesn't have that, so they didn't have anything. They basically provided everything as best they could, but, you know, they don't have all this stuff that they're asking for because PyPI doesn't function like that. But I mean, you got to think, even, you know, this is an open source project. These are ostensibly good guys. They're not doing anything with your data, and yet it was still subpoenaed. So you got to think, if somebody is collecting up all this data, even if they're on the side of the angels, you're counting on anyone who can force them to give that data up also being on the side of the angels. And given that I don't know what was being investigated, I don't know that they weren't. You know, maybe these are Python packages for something horrible. I don't know. But it's more just to point out that you've got to be aware that anytime a company is keeping data on you, and just assume they all could be, that data is potentially subject to, well, if nothing else, a subpoena.
Potentially, it is subject to a subpoena.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it potentially somebody could issue a subpoena is what I mean. So, just something to keep in mind with all the data collection that goes on these days. I know a lot of people are used to it now. You know, it's like, oh, well, yeah, your phone tracks you. Well, what else is new? Oh, well, got to have a Microsoft account to do anything on your computer. Oh, well, I guess that's just how it is. It's like, really? Think about what all that means. You know, if you're using a Microsoft account to sign into your computer, that means Microsoft has a record of every time you've logged into your computer, even if all you did was load up and look at something on your hard drive or run a local program that doesn't do anything on the internet. Microsoft would still have a record of what you did and when. You know, do you care about that? 99% of the time, probably not. But
depends on
what it is.
You know, how much of what you're doing they can actually watch. Is if I'm pulling up, I don't know, random bookkeeping software, I might not care that they know I'm using Intuit Pro, but what's actually in that software, I'm going to want them to know. Well, they don't need to know my account receivables.
Depending on what settings you've set in Windows, for example, if you've enabled Cortana, everything you type is potentially going up to Microsoft servers on a Windows 10 or 11 machine. And I don't.
And then you got to think.
I mean everything.
Oh, go ahead, sorry. Yeah.
I mean every fucking thing you type because Windows hooks it at the API level. And they don't hide it, by the way. If you go into ink and typing settings in Windows 10, you can see where it's got different settings for what level of detail to send up to Microsoft. Like, that's not a secret. Windows 10 and 11 has a built-in keylogger. Just most people
and
ignore
that,
it.
You've got to worry about what if I get hacked, and then what if what if Microsoft gets hacked? All of my account info, the hacker now has.
Yeah, here it is. Inking and typing personalization, getting to know you. Use your typing history and handwriting patterns to create a personal dictionary that makes better suggestions for you. When this is switched off, your personal typing and inking directory will be cleared, but the standard directory will continue to provide typing suggestions, or standard dictionary will continue to provide typing suggestions and handwriting recognition. If you turn that on, it's collecting everything you type and sending it up to Microsoft to try to make Cortana work better. They don't really say the whole sending it to Microsoft
part. I wonder
how long
that's stored at
Microsoft. But it is. Say what?
I don't wonder how long it's stored at Microsoft and how it's attached to you.
No idea. I mean, that's hard to know if you don't work there, you know what I mean? See what they're doing.
Yeah, but it's still scary to think how responsible are they being with this information and how anonymized is it?
Well, they claim it's anonymized, but researchers have routinely de-anonymized data that companies claimed was anonymized, so that just depends on what all they've done to it. I mean, again, without seeing what they've done and checking it, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
But
so the answer is not very probably.
How responsible are they being with it? I don't think they're being unresponsible with it. But how do you know how long that's going to last? Like, and even if they are being responsible with it, I wonder how many subpoenas Microsoft gets in a day. I mean, they run Office 365, for God's sake.
Well, it's not just subpoenas. I mean, those could be legitimate actors going after actual criminals.
Yeah, they could.
I'm pretty sure Microsoft's being targeted by criminals. It's just another area where a bad guy can get your information. Just because someone at Microsoft clicked a phishing email.
Sure, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, it's. I know I've said it before. I'm going to be making a real effort to switch to Linux sometime this year on my main machine because I've did some digging. Apparently, it's not that hard to get Fedora set up to do the graphic stuff. I mean, you have to actually install it, install some drivers and stuff like that. My problem is I was trying to do it all in live environments to see how well the hardware worked, because in the past, that method had worked for me. But I guess not so much this day and age. So, but apparently, Fedora is not that hard to get up and running correctly if you have to enable RPM Fusion and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm going to be looking into that because it's getting harder and harder to, you know, guarantee that what you're doing on your system is the only thing you think you're doing. And if everything is reporting, recording and logging everything you do, I mean, well, and even things like, okay, let's say the company's responsible with your data and they've got good security and they're not going to do anything bad with it. Well, what happens if another company comes along and buys them? Buys out the first company. Actually, a good example of that. Back in the day, the last couple of years, Radio Shack was operating. I guess they're still technically operating, but the last couple of years they were a major retailer. Every time you bought something in there, even if it was just a pack of batteries, they were always trying to get your name, phone number, and address from you, an email address from you. You say, no, I don't feel like putting that in. Oh, well, it's so we can send you discounts. I just don't want to put my name on a list. You know, they would argue with you. I think they were told to, you know, be real aggressive about it. At least the Radio Shacks I went to. Well, I remember seeing an article. First thing that happened when Radio Shack went under and started selling off assets, what they do, they sold off that customer list.
Yeah, that was the first thing they sold.
So
it was the most valuable thing they had left as an asset.
Yeah. So, you know, how do you know that the leadership of that company is going to be just as good 10 years down the line and not, you know, sell off that database to somebody? You know, imagine what's going to happen with Facebook when, you know, a couple more years from now, the current leadership of that company steps down and you get somebody else in there. I mean, you know, arguably they're already not great about the data collection and sharing it with third parties. So imagine somebody else in there who's, you know, purely business school, how do we maximize profit versus, you know, at least remembering what they built, you know? You start getting those kind of people in charge, and they're like, well, we found a new profit center and selling off this data. You think they're not going to immediately start doing that? Let's continue the bandwagon of, you know, being scared of all this data collection. Unless you guys had anything else on that before I go to the next article.
No, I'm good.
This one's from Reuters. Psychro sent it to me. FBI misused intelligence database in 278,000 searches, court says. Surprising nobody, but still. Is from May 19th. A U.S. court found that the FBI improperly searched for information in a U.S. database of foreign intelligence 278,000 times over several years, including on Americans suspected of crimes, according to a ruling released on Friday. The decision by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was released by the Office of the National, or Office of the Director of National Intelligence. I wanted to call this office Odin, but it's O-D-N-I. Just, it kind of looks like Odin for some reason there. But the searches occurred in the course of U.S. crime investigations, including the January 6th Capitol riots and protests after the 2020 killing of George Floyd, the court said. The intelligence database stores digital and other information on individuals. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allows the FBI to search, without a warrant, communications of foreigners abroad, including their conversations with Americans. The court ruling found that the FBI violated rules around the use of the database created under Section 702 of the FISA Act with its searches. Specifically, the court found that the searches, as part of probes into crimes from 2016 and 2020, violated the rules because there was, quote, no reasonable basis to expect that they would return foreign intelligence or evidence of crime, unquote, although the FBI believed that this was, quote, reasonably likely, unquote, the decision said. The revelations came as Joe Biden's administration is trying to garner congressional support to keep surveillance powers under Section 702, which is set to expire later this year. The ODNI said the FBI tightened its procedures in mid-2021 and 2022. As a result, these compliance incidents do not reflect the FBI's querying practices subsequent to the full deployment of the remedial measures, unquote, the office said. In other words, don't worry, we fixed it.
I don't believe them. And we need to pass some legislation to give teeth to the punishments for misusing this information. And also do away with the FISA court.
Just don't collect
it. They should just need to go.
Think about it for a second here. It's not a question of does this database exist and what's in it. We know they exist. The question is that the FBI was improperly accessing it.
Yeah.
Don't collect it in the first
place. Increase the penalty for it. They have a right to spy on foreign countries, and that's where they're picking up information on some of us. Because I talked to somebody in a foreign country. But they have a right and a responsibility to actually spy on foreign countries. They're the ones that are a threat to our country.
Madman, you and I are talking to somebody from a foreign country right now.
Yep. And that means if he's done something that's gotten the attention of the FBI, he could be monitored right now if they know how to monitor us.
We're going to need you to change your moniker and start using a fake accent, because I know you've done something to get the FBI's attention.
Oh, I've done plenty. You do. Hell, I committed a major felony the first fucking 24 hours on the ground in the States. Yeah, it was the first 4 hours I committed a major felony.
Probably shouldn't
As
be
I was
admitting
saying,
that.
Do away with the FISA court, because they shouldn't be going through a secret court to get permission to look at my info. And I should be able to challenge it, because now we're talking with the rights of a U.S. citizen.
Well, yeah, you don't even have the right to face your accuser.
Accuser.
Yeah. Oh.
That's the problem with the FISA court. Do away with it. The FBI can go get a subpoena from a court, and I can challenge their right to look at my info.
So, I agree. I don't.
And we need to put some teeth behind you access this database without going through the proper steps. I guess who gets 10 years in jail?
Just start flogging people. Or the stocks. Ooh, that'd be a good way to do it.
Yep.
Stocks in front of a local high school. Oh, sorry. You go ahead.
No, always bring back public executions for crime. Or we should go back to the, what was the old system where the banker, if he went bankrupt, he had a year to pay you back. If he didn't do that, he was killed.
Oh, they owed these property to make you whole, but that's also before they were incorporated.
Oh, I don't know if these audio glitches are making it through to the broadcast and recording. If they are, I think my ISP is being shitty. I was having problems with it earlier today, too, so not really much I can do about it. I can, you know, did all the standard, restart everything, check for problems, but...
I've been checking the stream every now and then, and I haven't heard anything yet.
Does the story actually list, does something other than bad boys happen to these guys? Because I don't think anyone's going to be fine, lose their job, or go to jail.
Well, look at the Durham report, dude. No one's even making a move on that. It flat out admits crimes against the state.
I read the story in its entirety.
Two people. Yeah. We found that they're doing something wrong. We're not doing anything about it. That's the story.
I did not read the story in its entirety. I left off the last line that the FBI did not respond for comment. Now I've read the story in its entirety.
Yeah. Dude, no one gets prosecuted for shit anymore. None of our countries are serious countries anymore. They're just jokes.
That's the fucking problem. They should be charging people. Someone was responsible for overseeing all of those inquiries.
Have you not figured out we're in the era where no one's responsible for anything? It's no one's fault because they had a hard time here, or they misread that, or they're just not used to our customs, or
they had a sexual emergency. Yeah,
exactly, dude. No one's accountable for anything. So why should the FBI be accountable for their behavior?
Because we're supposed to be a country of laws, not men.
We're not. We're a joke. With countries.
Everything is fine. Everything is fine.
Every Five Eyes nation's a fucking joke. They're not a serious country, because serious countries prosecute people for crimes.
I used to have Alex Jones saying emergency on the soundboard, and I can't find it now. That would have been great.
Good.
Oh, well.
Dojo?
No, I got two stories left.
All right.
We've got 10 minutes. It won't take long to get through these because I don't think we're going to have too much to say other than just pointing at them. This one's from Business Insider. An online fashion retailer has blocked 42,000 customers from its site. So just flat out blocked them. After the company said they had returned too many items they had purchased. Sweden-based Boots... go ahead.
I was going to say, change your return policy.
Yeah, really. Sweden-based Boots AB said the returns were too costly for the company and for the environment. Boots policy is part of a larger trend among retailers who are holding customers accountable for making too many returns, as insiders at RV Hartman's recently reported. While levying these measures against customers isn't new, shoppers are making more returns than ever before, insider reported. And processing of those returns can be inexpensive for or can be expensive for retailers. Online orders can cost 21% on orders value. Analyst, okay, this goes on, analyzing the number of returns. But really, it's just the fact that they've flat out blocked people from their website because they've returned too many things. So it's like, damn. I mean, I guess it's not really a new practice, you know, firing a customer who's too much of a problem to deal with, but just flat out blocking them from the website seems excessive.
Yeah. How else do you make sure you don't do business with them?
I guess.
I mean, I guess they could block their checking account, but then they could just use a different method of payment.
So... yeah, that one's more just kind of like, wow, guys. I'm just wondering, what counts as too many returns? Like, more than two?
Oh, I know what I used to define it as, but that was just because I was targeting shoplifters. These guys aren't shoplifters. They actually had to pay and have this shit shipped to them.
So... but yeah, maybe, or like you said, fix your return policy if you can't actually maintain it and you have to block people who take advantage of it.
Yeah, your return policy's got a problem. That's all it is. A couple of lines in the return policy.
So, all right. The last post, or last article I have for tonight is from New York Post. Delivery app DoorDash was hit with a $1 billion lawsuit for allegedly slamming iPhone users with higher fees than it charged its Android operating counterparts, claiming, quote, likely because studies reveal iPhone users earn more, unquote. What the fuck? The explosive class action suit, which means nobody's going to get a dime off of it except for the lawyers, filed in the U.S. District Court of Maryland on May 5th, claims that the food delivery service engages in deceptive, misleading, and fraudulent practices with illegal fees for customers with Apple iOS devices. These illegal fees are systematically used to mark up orders by as much as $2 for iPhone users than other devices, even if the order is exactly the same, quote, likely because studies reveal iPhone users earn more, unquote, the suit says. Quote, these tactics are simple money grabs, unquote, according to the complaint by Ross Hecox, a single father of two who uses DoorDash and subscribes to Dash Pass, a service that that gives subscribers exclusive discounts. So they're saying he's a current user of the... I would think that you would have uninstalled the app and canceled your subscription if you're suing the company. The fee in question is listed as an expanded range charge on the mobile app, which is applied to orders when a restaurant is outside the customer's normal delivery area. But DoorDash never actually clarifies what the normal delivery area is, the suit says. It also claims the fees affiliated with a delivery area or delivery radius on the app are not associated with geography, but rather, quote, how much money a restaurant pays DoorDash, unquote. DoorDash denied allegations of the lawsuit. They're saying they don't change their pricing based on your phone, period. Yeah, DoorDash is denying it, but then they've got screenshots here showing people comparing iPhone and Android and showing that the iPhone, yeah, the price is $2 higher. So, I don't know. But again, this comes down to all that metadata these companies are collecting. They're deciding you earn more so you can pay more. I mean... you know, I was at a self-checkout the other day, and it popped up and asked if I wanted to put a tip on my purchase, and it's like, the fuck?
What? If it's going to out you, don't say it, but what company wants you to tip for self-service?
Well, okay, it wasn't quite self-service, but it was Subway.
Oh. Okay.
I mean, it might as well have been. It was a bag of chips and a Coke. That I filled up at the, you know, so it's like, and they want to, they suggested a 15% tip. And it's like, at a fast food restaurant, you're expecting a tip now. Fuck you. If you want a tip, charge yeah. change your prices. But yeah. You know, I mean, all these little self-checkouts putting a tip on there. And, of course, the default option is like a 15% tip. And it's like, if you're just doing next, you're not going to notice that you're doing it. They're just trying to inflate prices wherever they can. So, pay attention, read shit. But I don't doubt that DoorDash is changing their prices based on who the person ordering is. I really don't. Because everyone's doing it.
I don't doubt it because they inflate the price of menu items. That pisses me off. Charge me the item price in the store and then just whatever your fee is. Don't hide your fees among shit.
Well, it is pretty amazing how DoorDash manages to like double or even triple the cost of just going through a drive-thru, you know? So... got to be kind of careful when you use it. Got to be sure you're really in a situation
it's
where
it makes
sense.
It's forced me to be less lazy.
So. Anyways, do you have anything on that one?
No, it's one of the reasons I pay cash.
Hadouken! This is a neat one. Hackaday has this article on building a fairly modern voltaic pile. So anybody who's not aware, a voltaic pile is kind of generally believed to be the first form of battery that people used. It's literally alternating metals with, some kind of...
metal and an insulator?
Well, no, it's not an insulator. It's usually going to be... most modern examples use, like, paper towel. But pretty much something to hold... or paper. Something that you can soak in an electrolyte to keep the plates separated, but still have the electrolyte between them. So in this case, it's alternating strips of I think it's aluminum and zinc. Wait, they say in here. Electrolyte is nothing more than salt water. Tissues are used to facilitate alternating zinc and copper. Okay, not aluminum. Yeah, so they've got a copper plate, a zinc plate, and piece of tissue between them. And then in his video there, he's showing he's getting about 3 volts off of it when he starts pouring salt water on it. So yeah, it absolutely works. I mean, this totally was the early power source before Tesla and Edison figured out a lot of how this shit worked. But and not, they're not the only ones. There's a lot of them. A lot of people who are involved in that. But those are the two names people know. So, but what's funny is when you look up the history of electronic engineering, and you figure out just how many of our common terms. Like farads and volts come from people's names. It's just like, wait, somebody's name was Volt? That's fucking awesome. Of course, it wasn't quite as rad back then, but nowadays. So, anyways,
that was almost inappropriate.
I don't care.
Oh no, I'm gonna keep that. I'll tell it off air.
So
apparently the FBI could be listening.
Or at least indexing it for their database
later. Wouldn't want to get you fine gentlemen in trouble.
I'm not scared.
I'm sure somewhere there's somebody in the FBI who occasionally has to check these recordings. And we apologize to that person for making them listen to this. But yeah, it's just a neat little project.
You got to start from the ground floor.
Yeah. It's a neat project because it's a modern spin on a voltaic pile because it's a 3D printed case and they're using springs to keep all the plates compressed. And so it's kind of, it's more science fair than anything, but it's neat to see the project, So I thought I got a kick out of it. But anyways, that's all we got for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. Well, mostly every Thursday. I think I'm going to miss some. Here in the next couple of weeks, but we'll see. course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. The Galaxy 15 radio site and subreddit in the IRC tonight. Al Hazard, Cyberlord, Madman, myself, and Sardonyx. Madman, closing thoughts.
This week, I'm going to find out what that $5 fee is on pizza delivery.
That's we wanted more money from you, fee.
I can assume that, but I'm going to actually find out what that is.
Good luck. Are you? Closing thoughts.
I was just thinking, if you're the FBI officer who has to listen to this, your supervisor does not respect you at all.
We're sorry. Your call cannot be completed as dialed.
And now I don't suffer, because I got a bottle of 60 warm hugs from God.